This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we hear from both the Republican and Democratic candidates in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. Coming up, Democratic challenger Bob Goodrich. But first, Republican Congressman Justin Amash is seeking his 3rd term in the U.S. House. He currently represents Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in Michigan's 3rd District. He joins us today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek. Justin Amash, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Gordon.
And we're also joined today by Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Justin Amash, why don't you begin by reintroducing yourself to our audience and tell us what you would like to do with another 2 years in the House.
Well, I'm the congressman from the 3rd District. I've represented this area over here in Calhoun County for the past 2 years, and I've represented Kent County and Ionia and Barry and that region for about 4 years. And served in the State House before I was in Congress. I'm from the Grand Rapids area. I am married and have 3 kids. And my main goals as a congressman are to ensure that people's rights are protected, to follow the Constitution and make sure that we are protecting civil liberties and looking out for the interests of ordinary Americans.
Mac McCullough, first question for Justin Amash.
All right, Congressman Amash, I just came from a meeting of about 100 people where the Coordinating Council of Calhoun County, and I asked them to what question I should ask you. We were talking about the United Way's recent ALICE study. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's a study that tracks how well people are able to meet basic needs, living above poverty, being employed, but being asset challenged. And the question was, how does public policy or the absence of it contribute to the high number of ALICE families in our communities?
Well, public policy has a huge impact. I mean, what we do at the federal level, but more importantly at the state and local level, affects families every day. And from my perspective, most economic decisions should be made as close to home as possible. So people in local communities need to make those decisions, and certainly working with your state legislature and working with the governor is the most critical element. A lot of times when the federal government gets involved, you end up with actually a lot of misallocation of resources because federal representatives don't have the same connection to the local community that maybe a state representative does or a local representative. The issues are just very different. So I prefer that you handle these kind of issues at the local level. And when policymakers decide that they're going to push for corporate welfare or allocate resources in a way that is inefficient, it can have a huge impact on the community.
Let me ask you about foreign policy. Do you consider the group known as the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL to be a threat to national security in the United States?
There's certainly a threat to people overseas. I've been in classified briefings, and what I can tell you is that the administration has not made a strong enough case to members of Congress, certainly many of the members I've spoken to, that ISIS is a threat to people here in the United States. So those are very different things, whether they're a threat overseas or here in the United States. We've certainly seen the atrocities they've committed. Some of the acts are horrific, and those who commit atrocities, we should certainly go after those people. But when you're talking about launching a full-scale war, you need to have, I think, strong evidence that there is a threat to people here at home.
Can you kind of define there, you say go after people is okay, but full
sure, if someone, if there's a video of someone beheading someone, certainly that person is a fair target. And those who assisted that person are fair targets for the President of the United States to go out and seek out to destroy them. But when you're talking about launching a full-scale war, perhaps an invasion of another country, then you need to have a stronger case that there is a threat here to the United States.
Mac.
Well, so you believe that the president is exceeding his authority?
Yes, absolutely, exceeding his authority.
Well, is his authority limited then to covert operations at this point, unless he goes to Congress for something more?
His authority is limited to actions that are repelling attacks or dealing with imminent threats. Every president has that authority that's under our Constitution. He has that executive authority. But when it comes to launching a war, he certainly has to go to Congress. He has to go to the American people and make the case. And the people's representatives in Congress and the House and Senate have to actually vote on an authorization to allow the president to launch offensive strikes.
When you say that you'd have to see more evidence, would you have to see evidence that ISIS is actually coming to American shores before they would get your vote for any authorization?
No, I wouldn't take it that far. I would say that you have to see evidence that attacks are being planned, that they are interested in attacking here at home. And I don't want to go into the details of what I hear at classified briefings, but it hasn't risen to the level where I think it is appropriate to launch a full-scale war.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans at the Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in downtown Battle Creek, speaking with Congressman Justin Amash, who is seeking his third term in the House. The Republican represents both Battle Creek and Grand Rapids in the 3rd District. And also here is Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough. Mac.
I'd like to jump to immigration, the issue there, and really describe your idea for immigration reform. What can Congress or should Congress be doing?
Well, there's a lot that Congress should be doing, and the question is whether we'll get Republicans and Democrats to come together and take the actions that need to be taken. Most members of Congress on both sides of the aisle think that we have to have some major immigration reform. There are differences of opinion about what that will entail, but I think you can get a consensus behind a few significant items. First, you have to have strong border security. And that's the place you have to start, certainly if you're going to get Republican votes in the House and in the Senate. Without strong border security, you don't have the assurance that you're going to be able to prevent further illegal immigration. So you have to have that. You have to improve our legal immigration system. There are people who have come here for generations. Most of our ancestors came here as legal immigrants. And that's to be encouraged, and that's something that is special to our country. We're a country of immigrants, and we believe in following our Constitution, following a set of principles, but we all come here as immigrants. So we don't have a national identity based on ethnicity like many other countries do. Our national identity is based on our beliefs, our belief in liberty and freedom. And we need to improve our legal immigration system. If you don't have a good legal immigration system, you encourage more illegal immigration because there are people who want to come here to work or to live, and because they feel they don't have any opportunity to even apply and make it into this country, they take more desperate measures. And so I would improve our legal immigration system. I think most members of Congress would agree with that. And then when it comes to those who are here illegally, you're not going to go house to house deporting people. If someone is caught committing a crime, they're caught in the act, yes, you can deport that person. But we're not going to send federal agents house to house to find people. So we need to create a system to bring people out of the shadows, to give people an opportunity to achieve legal status that doesn't mean citizenship, but just an opportunity to come out and become legal. And that would be over a long period of time, and they would have to pay some penalties as well.
You had a pretty strong response to some of the video that came out of Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death of Michael Brown there, specifically to the disturbances that happened and some of the equipment that the police had. If it was up to you solely, what would be the federal policy in terms of having some of this military equipment end up in the hands of police?
I think it's a mistake to send military-grade equipment to police. There are people involved in SWAT situations where someone is holed up in a house and they have hostages where the police certainly need better equipment. But what we shouldn't see is police on the streets pointing weapons at protesters and decked out in gear that is military grade in a way that frightens the population. I think we need to be respectful of the concerns of communities and ensure that people feel that the police are there to protect them and not to frighten them.
Is the role then for the federal government to say, yes, we can provide you that equipment, but there's some limits on when and where you can use it?
Well, that's one possibility. I think there are certain situations that might require a better police equipment, but the type of equipment we're seeing on some of the streets and the type of equipment being sent to police officers throughout the country are beyond what would be normally used in those situations. Sometimes we're talking about grenades and other items that probably don't have a real use in typical situations. And the way the law is written right now, these local police are required to actually use these items within a period of time, or else they're denied access to them in the future. So it's the federal policy actually encourages local police to put these into use and to put them on the streets when they might not be necessary.
Mac.
Shifting to education, should the federal government have any role in setting standards for public education for the states?
I don't think so. The state governments should handle these issues, and certainly I would prefer that standards be handled as locally as possible, even more local than the state government. When the federal government gets involved, it sets a one-size-fits-all policy for the whole country, and you get state governments and local governments that become so dependent on the federal government that they stop competing with each other. They follow the federal standards, for example, with Common Core, and if they can't abide by those standards, they lose funding. And that's a dangerous situation where you have local governments and school districts dependent on the federal government to set all the standards and dependent on them for the funding. You end up with basically no competition across the country.
But the other side of Common Core, they'll argue, look, we're in a worldwide competition right now. And frankly, people move around a lot more than they used to. So shouldn't there be some sort of national standard that everyone's got to reach, at least a bottom floor that everyone's got to be at?
Not a federally set standard. I think that if you had local governments deciding these things, state governments deciding these things, that would be a better system than what we have now, because you'd encourage more competition. You'd actually be able to raise standards. But the way you have it under Common Core, school districts are actually punished for being creative. They're punished for not following the Common Core standards because they won't receive federal funding. And I've consistently opposed things like Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind, because I don't think the federal government should have that role. It stifles innovation, it stifles creativity, and our kids are too important to have just a one-size-fits-all policy for the whole country. Some kids really struggle with certain types of learning. Other kids are great at other things, and we should have our teachers with the greatest flexibility possible so they can decide how they teach their classrooms to get the most out of their students.
We're down to just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you a little bit about the label that gets put on you quite often, libertarian Republican, libertarian-leaning Republican. How much are you libertarian? How much are you Republican?
Well, Republican's my party. Libertarian is my philosophy. So I don't think there's any contradiction there or anything unusual about it, just like there are liberal Democrats and progressive Democrats and conservative Democrats. There are different types of Republicans, and I consider myself a libertarian Republican or a conservative Republican. All it means is that I believe in following the Constitution and also allowing people to make decisions for their own lives. Those are the principles I follow every day as a congressman.
Justin Amash, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Republican Congressman Justin Amash is running for re-election in the 3rd U.S. House District, which includes Battle Creek and Grand Rapids. We've been speaking to him today at Western Michigan University's Kendall Center in Battle Creek. And thanks again to Battle Creek Inquirer Executive Editor Mac McCullough.
Thank you for inviting me.